Hi, I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Well, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're joined by a public figure that I suspect all of our listeners have heard of, have followed, and recognize, and that is Senator Jeff Sessions. Senator Sessions, thanks for being with us on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to be with you. I'm proud of what you're doing here.
Thank you, sir. Your career in public life, it has spanned several generations now. How did you get started? What was your first office that you occupied?
Well, I guess the first elected office was Alabama Attorney General, but I had formed in college the first Huntington College Young Republican Club ever. Later became president of Alabama State College Republicans and then the State Young Republicans. So I was sort of an advanced guard of Republicanism. We had a hard time at first. Every statewide elected official was a Democrat. There were only two Republicans in the entire legislature, but I kind of grew up with National Review, actually. And an English teacher, who was a brilliant professor, he said, Sessions, you need to be armed because when you get to college, they can lead you astray. I want you to read the National Review. So, in fact, I told William Buckley later, I said, you warped my brain as a teenager, and I never recovered. So I guess that's kind of where I deeply became committed to Republicans at a pretty early stage of the party's development in Alabama.
So before, of course, you were Alabama's attorney general, you were a U.S. attorney, appointed by President Reagan. Can you tell us a little bit? I think some of our listeners wonder, what does a U.S. attorney do?
Yeah, I had been an assistant United States attorney, and then I left, and Reagan appointed me in 81 as a United States attorney. There are three in Alabama. Some states just have one, some have several. So I was loved that job. I really loved that job. And we built a great staff, and we enforced federal law and defended the federal government in court from claims that were, we thought, unjust and not justified. So it was a great time, and we had a small office. I tried a lot of cases personally, some big cases, actually, a lot of big corruption cases, mayors and city councilmen and state senators and stuff that turned out to be pretty controversial. But we were generally successful in those cases. I took very seriously the responsibility to make sure you had a good case and that when you stood before a jury, you had the integrity and confidence of that jury that you were presenting a case fairly and justly. So I really enjoyed that time. My first elected office was after I left the U.S. Attorney's office after 12 years, which is very unusual to serve that long.
It does seem like a long tenure there, yeah.
Somebody said we less than 5% served 12 years. But I really, we had a great office and proud of it. Our goal was to be the best office in America, and that's what we tried to do. And so I got called after I left, and I really was not enjoying private practice as much as I enjoyed being U.S. attorney. And they asked me to run against an incumbent for Attorney General of Alabama. And finally, after some agony, decided I was going to do it. I felt like I knew what the job was about. I felt like I could assemble a good staff, as we'd done before, and that we could contribute to Alabama, and I was ready for that job. In September, one poll had me down 14 points, but when election day came, I won by 17.
Wow. So when you hold a position like U.S. Attorney or Attorney General of a state, what are some of the most important challenges that you deal with in that office? You're really the chief law enforcement officer, I think, right, of the state in Alabama?
Well, chief of our district of Alabama, and for the federal law enforcement. Well, I took the view, and it's the right view, that the job is not about us and the assistant United States attorneys that I led. I told them when they were hired, our job is to be as productive as possible to advance the duties of this office. And we were very good at handling a lot of cases and were successful at it. But volume, I think, was important, just like any governmental private business. I mean, you got to produce to justify the salary that they're paying you. And so we had a good team in that regard. Integrity is just critical. I'm a little worried about Washington today. This arguments about lawfare and some of those things, I don't think they realize how much confidence they've lost with the average American citizen. And I always was aware that you need to conduct yourself in a way that people would be sure that you were doing what the law required and not for political reasons. I kind of always had a pretty clear distinction in my mind between the political realm, which is a legitimate realm, and the legal realm, which is objectivity and justice. So that was some of the things that we worked on.
How about as Alabama's attorney general, what do you learn in an office like that?
Well, you learn a little bit about your dependence on the legislature. And federal judges I practiced before were far more objective than some of the state judges we had to, who often had political agendas, at least it seemed to me, on some of the cases we brought. So it was difficult. So you had the politics of elected attorney general as compared to the U.S. attorney, which was essentially a non-political office.
Then, of course, that you became United States senator. And what's so interesting to me is you've served now in the legislature, and you served for a number of years as U.S. senator from Alabama. But you served in the legislature, and you've served in the executive branch. Can you compare those two? What's it like to be a U.S. senator?
U.S. senators are very good at sounding like they know what they're talking about when often they don't. You can be walking down the subway in the Capitol, and they stick a microphone in your face, and you got an answer. But you might not, probably is an answer that's fairly amenable to the party of which you're a part and your people back home. You get skilled at that. But I do think that sometimes the Congress, the Senate, and the House don't quite know what they're doing on some of the most serious questions. I know I didn't. And I think that they are not able to, sometimes because of the pressures for all kinds of issues that come upon them. So you tend to follow your party leadership. So, for example, I was a tremendous supporter of George Bush and his administration. We supported the 9/11 response in Afghanistan and Iraq and the strong military and push out. But as time went by, I had doubts that this was working out. And I got to say, very, very few people in Congress gave long-term thought to the implications of taking over a country like Afghanistan and trying to create a modern democracy and to reverse their social and cultural and family traditions that are deep, deep, deep tribal. And to the same degree in Iraq, although it was a little different. And so I remember asking some key witnesses who've been there and working in those areas for the government, don't we need to be a little more modest about what we think we can accomplish? And they would always say, yes. Anybody that's been there knew this is no little matter to try to run Afghanistan. As big as it is, with people all over, with most of them illiterate, and we're going to create a constitution which we were able to create, understand, and support in America. That's a very, very, very unusual thing, that you could write a constitution and that the people of this country could actually understand it, support it, defend it with their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor. So you didn't have that in Iraq and Afghanistan and a lot of other places we've been involved in. You do learn in the Senate and the House over time, sometimes they get worse.
That was my question, actually. I was just wondering, because that's a really interesting point that you're making, which is, of course, people arrive in the U.S. Senate knowing some things from their background, but not knowing remotely everything about all the issues that a senator faces. That would be impossible, I think. But then you said, but you do learn over time. What were the ways that you learned more and got more deeply, a deeper understanding of the issues that faced the country and that faced you as a senator? How did you learn?
That's a good question, actually. First of all, when in doubt, which is most of the time, you just tend to follow party leadership, and you assume that they know. They assume that they're talking to the Defense Department or their Secretary of Energy, and that the policy they're coming forward, which you generally like, so you become supportive of it. And you can talk about that pretty intelligently. However, these issues, all of them, become pretty complicated if you really know about it. In time, I came to realize I knew as much as they did, and neither one of us knew much. Remember talking about my Senate leadership? Why do they know? They've been here 20 years when I got to the Senate. They should know everything. They don't know anything either. General, you have a philosophy that guides you. I used to call them directional votes. Do you want to make this agency bigger or not? Do you want to, you think it's wasting money and it ought to be more efficient or not? Should we expand this program or not? So my directional views were pretty deep, going back to Goldwater and William Buckley and that. And so I had to be convinced about these things.
But then over time, it is true. If we look at your public record over time in the Senate, it's certainly true that you did not always follow party leadership, that sometimes you were willing to question, sometimes even buck leadership on certain issues, for example, on trade. How did you come to the position where you got to the point where you said, I'm not sure I agree with party leadership on these kind of issues?
I came to grasp that the number one policy of the United States can't just be making GDP bigger. There's a human factor out here. And I came to believe that we represented, as members of Congress, everybody. And half of America makes less than $65,000 a year, median income. So who's speaking for them? In some purity of libertarian ideology and market theory, we're not in a free market. We've never been in a free market. And so you do have to ask questions. Is this economy serving everybody? That's a big deal. Are these people cheating us? Are these competitive countries, competitors, subsidizing their factories? And are we not responding? And are they closing our factories? And we're losing our jobs? We're losing the manufacturing base? Are we going to give the lowest, whoever got the lowest bid in the world gets to build our ships? Is that the only question? Is there a national security question? Is there a need to maintain good jobs for American citizens? I guess one of my first fights on trade was a Trans-Pacific Partnership, It had bipartisan support. Everybody was for it. And I'm thinking, why in the world should the United States sign on to this agreement? Everybody gets one vote. The Sultan of Brunei gets one vote. And we're just going to turn our economy over the greatest market, greatest manufacturing center in the history of the world, the United States, to other people to decide how we conduct policy. So I opposed it. It finally came out of the Senate with less votes than they started. And the leadership was all for it. George Bush was for it. Barack Obama was for it. Then Donald Trump came down the elevator in New York and announced his candidacy for president. And he started hammering the TPP and said we need to protect American manufacturing. And all of a sudden, the steam went out of that. It never came up in the House for even for a vote. And Hillary Clinton eventually said she was against it. But at the time, I was about the only one. And I thought I was acting in a principled way to protect the legitimate people.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
In a situation like that, where you're bucking your party leadership and you're bucking the consensus among both parties, sometimes that leads to interesting political allies where you might not expect to work with some people. Is that what happened in your case, for example, fighting TPP?
Yeah, we had a few Democrats, but they basically all went with Obama on that. But a few, but you did. And most of the votes came from Republicans. So there was a lot. And immigration was a similar battle. Immigration, the leadership was always wanting to pass something. And at the rawest financial base, it is that corporations wanted more cheap labor. And without the importation of large amounts of workers, they would have to pay higher wages to Americans. And for 20 years, wages had fallen below inflation in America. And they said, we've got to have these foreign workers to do our high-tech jobs. But I know that's not true. We had a hearing. I chaired it in the Judiciary Committee. Wages hadn't gone up for high-tech workers for 15, 20 years. That is proof there's no shortage. If you have a shortage, wages will go up. So we have not as much attractiveness for a college student to take a high-tech degree because they weren't going to be able to get much that higher wages, whereas we were bringing in thousands of people on the programs legally and illegally, really, to fill those slots. One time, the high-tech industry laid off thousands, tens of thousands of workers in they were still saying we need to bring in more foreign workers, which is baloney. And I said, Hewlett-Packard laid off about 40,000. I said, why don't you call Mr. Hewlett and ask him if you can hire some of his people instead of bringing them in from abroad? They wanted the extra supply. So I guess you would say I would began to believe we should do a better job of defending the interest of the average American who was not prospering to the degree that GDP and corporate profits were prospering. And that's an unhealthy thing for a society.
Much of your career, I mean, you're here, of course, to talk on Constitution Day and the importance of the Constitution and the rule of law. Much of your career has been about enforcing the law, making law and enforcing law. How did you become interested in law?
Well, I'm not real sure. I think, like reading National Review, that was had a lot of legal thought in it. I would watch TV programs about the law. Dean Clarence Mannion, retired dean from Notre Dame, you know, he had a program on about law, and I would watch that for some crazy reason. I guess people thought I was stupid. But I got interested in it that way. There were no lawyers in my family. We're just rural, small-town people. Parents were educated, but not on. But they came up during the Depression and really didn't get a college degree. So I would say that I don't know how that exactly developed. I graduated with a history major, where I appreciate you, in a little liberal arts college like Ashland University. And that was a blessing to me. And then it was hard to find a job with a history major. So law school was the next step.
You've devoted a lot of your public life to thinking about the Constitution, to interpreting the Constitution, to enforcing the law and the Constitution. Why, and you've been pretty outspoken in your belief that it's important for everyone in America, not just judges, but everyone, to study the Constitution.
They need to know what it's about. The first thing we need to know about the Constitution is that it is the backbone of this entire society and culture. It protects us. It must be protected. It must be venerated. The words have to have meaning. We had a professor from William and Mary, Professor Van Alstyne, one time said, well, I'm a liberal, but I believe you have to enforce the words of the Constitution as written if you respect the Constitution. Twist the meaning of words to make it say what you wanted to say today, then you don't respect it, and it weakens it for all purposes. This is a threat. I was a strong believer in the originalist doctrine, and we had many battles in the Senate over confirmations and the direction of the courts, and I was pretty active in that because the judges take an oath to serve under the laws and the Constitution of the United States. And they're not above it. They don't get to redefine the meaning of words to make it say what they'd like it to say. They serve the language of the Constitution. And you have to fairly interpret the words of the Constitution as they were intended when the elected people passed them. And if you don't, then you're politicizing the courts. And you lose respect, and it's not the proper order. The pressure should go on the legislatures if you're unhappy with the results of some policy. The legislature and the presidents and executives set policy, not the courts. So I think I never would have thought we would be in a position where there are six originalists on the Supreme Court, and all they're doing is simply reading the laws faithfully and doing their best to interpret what the meanings are. And that's what we expect. And the political matters get decided among the people.
Of course, you also served as U.S. Attorney General. And sometimes I think people forget that members of Congress, members of the U.S. Senate, and members of the legislative executive branch also have to interpret the Constitution because they have to enforce the law, but they have to do it constitutionally. Can you talk a little bit about, in your time as U.S. Attorney General, how you thought about the constitutional aspect of your office, how you interpreted the Constitution to make sure that you were enforcing the law constitutionally?
Well, yeah, I think that's important. And a lot of things continued to come up even more in recent years that were pretty clearly in violation of the constitutional privilege. So you have individual duty to make a good faith judgment as to whether a legislative act is constitutional. You should not vote for it if it's unconstitutional. Shouldn't throw it up and hope the court might let it go pie because you want to.
And very often legislators will do that. Yeah. They'll say, it's not our business to decide the constitutionality. We'll let the courts sort it out. You don't agree with that.
No, and they mostly won't say it publicly. The polling data, people want to see this agenda happen, and they want to pass something, and somebody says it's unconstitutional. They don't want to hear it. They're going to vote for it and go back home and say, I supported this bill. I'm sorry the courts threw it out. But that's not a healthy way. In the long run, that's not healthy.
You're, over the course of your years in public service, I'm sure you've learned a lot of lessons. Some, maybe some the hard way too. But to think about for young people, thinking about going into a life of public service, contemplating that life, what's some advice you would give them that you've learned along the way?
Well, you need to know who you are and what your values are. And they need to be good values. And you should form them now before you get in the political hot spot. I sort of did that. I mean, I started in high school and all and developed. And my values are pretty much the same. I've gotten a lot smarter and changed my view on a lot of things. But my directional approach has not changed much. And so I judge things based on those principles that I hold dear. So I would say to young people, first of all, think clearly about the issues of the world and how you approach government. Secondly, you need to know what you're doing. I think I'd like to run for office, and I would ask them, well, have you prepared yourself? Have you thought about these issues? Have you studied these issues? To what extent do you know anything about them? Or you just want to run and be an office holder? And so you want people who have a passion for things, and if you're voting, you want to vote for those who have a passion for things you believe. That's the way democracy is. So I do think young people should prepare themselves and not just assume that one day they'd like to be an office holder. How do you do it? Well, everybody's different. I won't try to answer that right now, but I do think you should prepare yourself and you should establish a reputation. So I started out working in the losing Republican vineyards in Alabama. We lost every election. But so I got to know a lot of people, and they got to like me. They figured I was a good guy, and I had principles. And so when I decided to run for attorney general, within the party, I wasn't known outside of the South Mobile and all of Alabama, but they knew I was a pretty good guy. And they liked me and respected me. They figured I was capable of being Attorney General of Alabama. I didn't just walk off the street. I'd been U.S. Attorney 12 years. So Ronald Reagan had appointed me. That didn't hurt either. And so I kind of would say that to young people. You have to work your way up. Don't try to go too far too fast. But prove yourself step by step, and people will notice.
Is it a coincidence, or was it important that you were also a history major?
I think it was just important. I think going to like Ashland University, Ashbrook Fellows, I was raised in that kind of environment. Thought I'd go to Alabama or Auburn, and for the last minute, I went to a small liberal arts college where we had history, religion, 4 semesters of language, things like that that I would never have done at a big university. And I would say to young people, you don't have to follow the herd on Ohio State. You know, it's a big place. Maybe it is best for you. It's a great university, but maybe not. Maybe an Ashland or Ashbrook Center is a better place for you.
It's the American idea. It's the Ashbrook Center. We always have a deep interest in history, as you know. I always love to ask our guests their favorite person in American history? Maybe it's not a fair question because we've had so many great people in American history, but if we had to ask you, who's your favorite person in American history?
Well, in American history, it'd have to be George Washington. He was an indispensable man. He carried himself so well. He knew the role he filled. He knew. You got Washington pictures all around here. But so he knew his responsibility. What, 7 years of war, he went home one time just for a short period? He was on in the battlefield for 7 years, and it was very difficult. Then he gave up his office, resigned his commission. There's a painting here on that somewhere. He was commissioned to lead the war. He led the war. He won the war, and he resigned his commission, went back to his farm. That was important because it said that the civil authorities would organize the government, not the Revolutionary warrior that so happens, the Napoleons and the Castros and people like that who take over and dominate because they got the army with them and they got the power in chaos of a revolution. So Washington went home, the government called him back to preside at the convention and then called him to be the president on the Constitutional Convention, and then to be the first president. And he played that role, and he gave himself to his country. It was just remarkable restraint and wisdom he showed.
Fascinating. Well, that's a great choice and a great time, great conversation. Senator Sessions, thanks for taking the time to be with us on The American Idea.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.